can't. She put her hand against his chest. His heart was beating like trapped wings. Take me home then, she whispered, and she leaned up to brush her lips against the corner of his mouth. Or at least she meant it as a brush, a butterfly touch of lips on lips. But he leaned down toward her, and his movement changed the angle swiftly. She pressed up against him harder than she'd meant to, her lips sliding to center against his. She felt him breathe out in surprise against her mouth, and then they were kissing, really kissing, exquisitely slow and hot and intense. Take me home. But this was home, Jace's arms surrounding her, the cold wind of Alicante in their clothes, her fingers digging into the back of his neck, the place where his hair curled softly against his skin. His palms were still flat against the stone behind her, but he moved his body against hers, gently pressing her up against the wall. She could hear the harsh undertone of his breathing. He wouldn't touch her with his hands, but she could touch him. She let her hands go freely, over the swell of his arms, down to his chest, tracing the ridges of muscles, pressing outward to grip his sides until his t-shirt was rucking up under her fingers. Her fingertips touched bare skin, and then she was sliding her hands up under his shirt. And she hadn't touched him like this in so long, had nearly forgotten how his skin was soft where it wasn't scarred, how the muscles in his back jumped under her touch. He gasped into her mouth. He tasted like tea and chocolate and salt. She had taken control of the kiss. Now she felt him tense as he took it back, biting her lower lip until she shuddered, nipping at the corner of her mouth, kissing along her jawbone to suck at the pulse point at her throat, swallowing her racing heartbeat. His skin burned under her hands, burned. He broke away, reeling back almost drunkenly, hitting the opposite wall. His eyes were wide, and for a dizzy moment, Clary thought she could see flames in them, like twin fires in the darkness. Then the light went out of them, and he was only gasping as if he had been running, pressing the heels of his palms against his face. Jace, she said. He dropped his hands. Look at the wall behind you, he said in a flat voice. She turned and stared. Behind her, where he had been leaning, were twin scorch marks in the stone, in the exact shape of his hands.
The Sealy Queen lay upon her bed and looked up at the stone ceiling of her bedchamber. It was wreathed with dangling trellises of roses, thorns still intact, each one perfect and blood red. Every night they withered and died, and every morning they were replaced, as fresh as the day before. Fairy slept little and rarely dreamed, but the queen liked her bed to be comfortable. It was a wide couch of stone, with a feather mattress laid on top, and covered with thick swaths of velvet and slippery satin. "Have you ever," said the boy in the bed beside her, "pricked yourself on one of the thorns, Your Majesty?" She turned to look at Jonathan Morgenstern sprawled among the covers. Though he had asked her to call him Sebastian, which she respected, no fairy would allow another to address them by their true name either. He was on his stomach, head pillowed on his crossed arms, and even in the dim light, the old whip wheels across his back were visible. The queen had always been fascinated by shadow hunters. They were part angel, as were the fair folk. Certainly there should be a kinship between them, but had never thought she would find one whose personality she could stand for more than 5 minutes, until Sebastian. They were also dreadfully self-righteous. Not Sebastian. He was most unusual for a human, and for a shadow hunter especially. "Not so often as you cut yourself on your wit, I think, my dearest," she said. "You know I do not wish to be called Your Majesty, but only Lady, or My Lady, if you must. You do not seem to mind when I call you Beautiful One, or My Beautiful Lady." His tone was not repentant. She said, raking her slim fingers through the mass of his silvery hair. He had lovely coloring for a mortal, hair like a blade, eyes like onyx. She recalled his sister, so very different, not nearly so elegant. "Was your sleep refreshing? Are you weary?" He rolled over onto his back and grinned up at her. Not quite spent, I think. She leaned to kiss him, and he reached up to twine his fingers in her red hair. He looked at a curl of it, scarlet against the scarred skin of his knuckles, and touched the curl to his cheek. Before she could speak another word, a knock came at the door of her bedchamber. The queen called out, "What is it? If it's not a matter of importance, be off with you, or I shall have you fed to the Nixies in the river." The door opened, and one of the younger court ladies came in, Kaylee Whitewillow, a pixie. She curtsied and said, "My lady, Meliorn is here, and would speak with you." Sebastian quirked a pale eyebrow. A queen's work is never done. The queen sighed and rolled from the bed. "Bring him in," she said, "and bring me one of my dressing gowns as well, for the air is chill." Kaylee nodded and left the room. A moment later, Meliorn entered and bowed his head. If Sebastian thought it odd that the queen greeted her courtiers standing naked in the middle of her bedchamber, he did not evince it by any quirk of expression. A mortal woman would have been embarrassed, might have tried to cover herself. But the queen was the queen, eternal and proud, and she knew she was as glorious out of clothes as she was in them. "Meliorn," she said, "you have news from the Nephilim." He straightened. Meliorn wore, as he usually did, white armor in a design of overlapping scales. His eyes were green, and his hair was very long and black. "My lady," he said, and glanced behind her at Sebastian, who was sitting up on the bed, the coverlet tangled around his waist. "I have much news. Our new forces of Dark Ones have been situated at the fortress of Edom. They await further orders." "And the Nephilim?" the queen asked as Kaylee came back into the room carrying a dressing gown woven of the petals of lilies. She held it up, and the queen slipped into it, wrapping the silken whiteness about herself. "The children who escaped the Los Angeles Institute have given enough information that they know that Sebastian is behind the attacks," said Meliorn, rather sourly. "They would have guessed it anyway," said Sebastian. "They do have a regrettable habit of blaming me for everything." "The question is, were our people identified?" the queen demanded. "They were not," said Meliorn with satisfaction. "The children assumed all the attackers to be in Darkened." "That is impressive, considering the presence of fairy blood in that Blackthorn boy," said Sebastian. "One might have thought they'd be attuned to it. What are you planning on doing with him anyway?" "He has fairy blood. He is ours," said Meliorn. "Gwen has claimed him to join the Wild Hunt. He will be dispatched there." He turned to the queen. "We have need of more soldiers," he said. "The institutes are emptying. The Nephilim are fleeing to Idris." "What of the New York Institute?" Sebastian demanded sharply. "What of my brother and sister?" "Clary Frey and Jace Lightwood have been sent to Idris," said Meliorn. "We cannot attempt to retrieve them quite yet without showing our hand." Sebastian touched the bracelet on his wrist. It was a habit of his, the queen had noted, something he did when he was angry and trying not to show it. The metal was written on in an old language of humans. "If I cannot reach heaven, I will raise hell." "I want them," he said. "And you shall have them," said the queen. "I have not forgotten that was part of our bargain. But you must be patient." Sebastian smiled, though it did not reach his eyes. "We mortals can be over hasty." "You are no ordinary mortal," said the queen, and turned back to Meliorn. "My knight," she said, "what do you advise your queen?" "We need more soldiers," Meliorn said. "We must take another institute. More weapons would be a boon as well." "I thought you said all the shadow hunters were in Idris," Sebastian said. "Not quite yet," said Meliorn. "Some cities have taken longer than expected to evacuate all the Nephilim. The Shadowhunters of London Rio de Janeiro, Cairo, Istanbul, and Taipei remain. We must have at least one more institute. Sebastian smiled. It was the sort of smile that transformed his lovely face, not into something lovelier, but into a cruel mask, all teeth, like a manticore's grin. "Then I shall have London," he said, "if that does not go against your wishes, my queen." She could not help but smile. It had been so many centuries since a mortal lover had made her smile. She bent to kiss him and felt his hand slide over the petals of her gown. "Take London, my love, and turn it all to blood," she said. "My gift to you."
"You're all right?" Jace asked, for what felt to Clary like the 100th time. She was standing on the front step of Armitage's house, partly illuminated by the lights from the windows. Jace was just below her, his hands jammed into his pockets as if he were afraid to let them free. He had stared at the burn marks he'd made on the wall of the shop for a long time before tugging his shirt down and practically yanking Clary out into the crowded street as if she shouldn't be alone with him. He'd been taciturn the rest of the way home, his mouth set in a tense line. "I'm fine," she assured him. "Look, you burn the wall, not me." She did an exaggerated twirl as if she was showing off a new outfit. "See?" There were shadows in his eyes. "If I hurt you..." "You didn't," she said. "I'm not that fragile. I thought I was getting better at controlling it, that working with Jordan was helping." Frustration curled through his voice. "You are, it is. Look, you were able to concentrate the fire in your hands. That's progress. I was touching you, kissing you, and I'm not hurt." She put her hand against his cheek. "We worked through this together, remember? No shutting me out, no epic sulks." "I was figuring I could sulk for Idris in the next Olympics," Jace said, but his voice was already softening, the edge of hard self-loathing filed away, wryness and amusement taking its place. "You and Alec could go for pear sulking," said Clary with a smile. "You'd get the gold." He turned his head and kissed the palm of her hand. His hair brushed the tops of her fingers. Everything around them seemed still and quiet. Clary could almost believe they were the only people in Alicante. "I keep wondering," he said against her skin, "what the guy who owns that store is going to think when he comes to work in the morning and sees two handprints burned into his wall." "I hope I have insurance for this." Jace laughed, a small puff of air against her hand. "Speaking of which," said Clary, "the next council meeting is tomorrow, right?" Jace nodded. "War council," he said. "Only select members of the Clave." He wiggled his fingers irritably. Clary felt his annoyance. Jace was an excellent strategist and one of the Clave's best fighters and would have greatly resented being left out of any meeting that was about battles. Especially, she thought, if there was going to be discussion about using the heavenly fire as a weapon. "Then maybe you could help me out with something. I need an armaments shop. I want to buy a sword, a really good one." Jace looked surprised, then amused. "What for?" "Oh, you know, killing." Clary made a hand gesture she hoped conveyed her murderous intentions towards all things evil. "I mean, I've been a shadow hunter for a while now. I should have a proper weapon, right?" A slow grin spread across his face. "The best blade shop is Diana's on Flintlock Street," he said, eyes alight. "I'll pick you up tomorrow afternoon." "It's a date," Clary said. "A weapons date." "So much better than dinner and a movie," he said, and disappeared into the shadows. 5. Measure of Revenge. Maya looked up as the door to Jordan's apartment banged open and he raced inside, almost skidding on the slippery hardwood floor. "Anything?" he asked. She shook her head. His face fell. After they'd killed the Indarkened, she'd called the pack to come help them deal with the mess. Unlike demons, Indarkened didn't just evaporate when you killed them. Disposal was required. Normally, they would have summoned the Shadow Hunters and Silent Brothers, but the doors to the Institute and the Bone City were closed now. Instead, Bat and the rest of the pack had showed up with a body bag, while Jordan, still bleeding from the fight with the Indarkand, had gone to look for Simon. He hadn't come back for hours, and when he had, the look in his eyes had told Maya the whole story. He had found Simon's phone, smashed to pieces, abandoned at the bottom of the fire escape like a mocking note. Otherwise, there'd be no sign of him at all. Neither of them had slept after that, of course. Maya had gone back to Wolfpack headquarters with Bat, who had promised, if a little hesitantly, that he would tell the wolves to look for Simon and try, emphasis on try, to reach the shadow hunters in Alicante. There were lines open to the shadow hunter capital, lines that only the heads of packs and clans could use. Maya had returned to Jordan's apartment at dawn, despairing and exhausted. She was standing in the kitchen when he came in, a wet paper towel pressed to her forehead. She took it away as Jordan looked at her and felt the water run down her face like tears. "No," she said, "no news." Jordan slumped against the wall. He was wearing only a short-sleeved t-shirt, and the ink designs of lines from the Upanishads were darkly visible around his biceps. His hair was sweaty, plastered to his forehead, and there was a red line on his neck where the strap of his weapons pack had cut into the skin. He looked miserable. "I can't believe this," he said, for what felt to Maya like the millionth time. "I lost him, I was responsible for him, and I goddamn lost him. It's not your fault." She knew it wouldn't make him feel any better, but she couldn't help saying it. "Look, you can't fight off every vampire and baddie in the tri-state area, and the Praetors shouldn't have asked you to try. When Simon lost the mark, you asked for backup, didn't you? And they didn't send anyone, you did what you could." Jordan looked down at his hands and said something under his breath. "Not good enough." Maya knew she should go over to him, put her arms around him, comfort him. Tell him he wasn't to blame. But she couldn't. The weight of guilt was as heavy on her chest as an iron bar, words unsaid choking her throat. It had been that way for weeks now. "Jordan, I have to tell you something. Jordan, I have to... Jordan, I... Jordan..." The sound of a ringing phone cut through the silence between them. Almost frantically, Jordan dug into his pocket and yanked his mobile out. He flipped it open as he put it to his ear. "Hello?" Maya watched him, leaning so far forward that the countertop cut into her ribcage. She could hear only murmurs on the other end of the phone, though, and was nearly screaming with impatience by the time Jordan closed the phone and looked over at her, a spark of hopefulness in his eyes. "That was Teal Waxelbaum, second-in-command at the Praetor," he said. "They want me at headquarters right away. I think they're going to help look for Simon. Will you come? If we head out now, we should be there by noon." There was a plea in his voice under the current of anxiety about Simon. He wasn't stupid, Maya thought. He knew something was wrong. He knew. She took a deep breath. The words crowded her throat. "Jordan, we have to talk about something." But she forced them back down. Simon was the priority now. "Of course," she said. "Of course, I'll come."
The first thing Simon saw was the wallpaper, which wasn't that bad. A bit dated. Definitely peeling. Serious mold problem. But overall, not the worst thing he'd ever opened his eyes to. He blinked once or twice, taking in the heavy stripes that cut through the floral pattern. It took him a second to realize that those stripes were, in fact, bars. He was in a cage. He quickly rolled onto his back and stood, not checking to see how high the cage was. His skull made contact with the bars on top, knocking his gaze downward as he cursed out loud. And then he saw himself. He was wearing a flowing, puffy white shirt. Even more troubling was the fact that he also appeared to be wearing a pair of very tight leather pants. Very tight, very leather. Simon looked down at himself and took it all in. The billows of the shirt, the deep chest-exposing V, the tightness of the leather. "Why is it," he said after a moment, "that whenever I think I've found the most terrible thing that could happen to me, I'm always wrong?" As if on cue, the door opened, and a tiny figure rushed into the room. A dark shape closed the door instantly behind her, with Secret Service-like speed. She tiptoed up to the cage and squeezed her face between two bars.
Simon,
she breathed. Maureen. Simon would normally have at least tried to ask her to let him out, to find a key, to assist him. But something in Maureen's appearance told him that would not be helpful. Specifically, the crown of bones she was wearing. Finger bones. Maybe foot bones. And the bone crown was bejeweled, or possibly bedazzled. And then there was the ragged rose and gray ball gown, widened at the hips in a style that reminded him of those costume dramas set in the 18th century. It was not the kind of outfit that inspired confidence. "Hey, Maureen," he said cautiously. Maureen smiled and pressed her face harder into the opening.
"Do you like your outfit?" she asked. "I have a few for you. I got you a frock coat and a kilt and all kinds of stuff. But I wanted you to wear this one first. I did your makeup, too. That was me."
Simon didn't need a mirror to know he was wearing eyeliner. The knowledge was instant and complete.
"Maureen, I'm making you a necklace," she said, cutting him off. "I want you to wear more jewelry. I want you to wear more bracelets. I want things around your wrists."
"Maureen, where am I?"
"You're with me."
"Okay. Where are we?"
"The hotel, the hotel, the hotel."
The Hotel du Mort. At least that made some kind of sense.
"Okay," he said. "And why am I in a cage?"
Maureen started humming a song to herself and ran her hand along the bars of the cage, lost in her own world.
"Together, together, together. Now we're together. You and me, Simon and Maureen, finally."
"Maureen,
this will be your room," she said. "And once you're ready, you can come out. I've got things for you. I've got a bed and other things, some chairs, things you'll like, and the band can play."
She twirled, almost losing her balance under the strange weight of the dress. Simon felt he should probably choose his next words very carefully. He knew he had a calming voice. He could be sensitive, reassuring.
"Maureen, you know, I like you."
On this, Maureen stopped spinning and gripped the bars again.
"You just need time," she said with a terrifying kindness in her voice. "Just time. You'll learn. You'll fall in love. We're together now. And we'll rule. You and me. We will rule my kingdom, now that I'm queen."
"Queen?"
"Queen. Queen Maureen. Queen Maureen of the night. Queen Maureen of the darkness. Queen Maureen. Queen Maureen, Queen Maureen of the dead."
She took a candle that burned in a sconce on the wall and suddenly poked it between the bars and in Simon's general direction. She tipped it ever so slightly and smiled as the white wax dropped in tear-like forms to the rotted remains of the scarlet carpet on the floor. She bit her lower lip in concentration, turning her wrist gently, pooling the drips together.
"You're a queen?" Simon said faintly. He'd known Maureen was the leader of the New York vampire clan. She'd killed Camille, after all, and taken her place. But clan leaders weren't called kings or queens. They dressed normally, like Raphael did, not in costumey get-ups. They were important figures in the community of the Knight's Children. But Maureen, of course, was different. Maureen was a child, an undead child. Simon remembered her rainbow arm warmers, her little breathy voice, her big eyes. She'd been a little girl with all the innocence of a little girl when Simon had bitten her, when Camille and Lilith had taken her and changed her, injecting an evil into her veins that had taken all that innocence and corrupted it into madness. It was his fault, Simon knew. If Maureen hadn't known him, hadn't followed him around, none of this would have happened to her. Maureen nodded and smiled, concentrating on her wax pile, which was now looking like a tiny volcano.
"I need to do things," she said abruptly, and dropped the candle still burning.
It snuffed itself out as it hit the ground, and she bustled toward the door. The same dark figure opened it the instant she approached. And then Simon was alone again, with the smoking remains of the candle and his new leather pants, and the horrible weight of his guilt.
Maya had been silent the whole way to the Prater, as the sun had risen higher in the sky and the surroundings had turned from the crowded buildings of Manhattan to the traffic-clogged Long Island Expressway to the pastoral small towns and farms of the Norfolk. They were close to the Prater now, and could see the ice-blue waters of the Sound on their left rippling in the cool wind. Maya imagined plunging into them and shuddered at the thought of the cold. "Are you all right?" Jordan had hardly spoken most of the way either. It was chilly inside his truck, and he wore leather driving gloves, but they didn't conceal his white-knuckle grip on the wheel. Maya could feel the anxiety rolling off him in waves. "I'm fine," she said. It wasn't true. She was worried about Simon, and she was still fighting the words she couldn't say that choked her throat. Now wasn't the right time to say them, not with Simon missing, and yet every moment she didn't say them felt like a lie. They swung onto the long white drive that stretched into the distance toward the Sound. Jordan cleared his throat. "You know I love you, right?" "I know," Maya said quietly, and fought the urge to say thank you. You weren't supposed to say thank you when someone said they loved you. You were supposed to say what Jordan was clearly expecting. She looked out the window and started, jerked out of her reverie. "Jordan, is it snowing?" "I don't think so." But white flakes were drifting past the windows of the truck, building up on the windshield. Jordan brought the truck to a stop and rolled one of the windows down, opening his hand to catch a flake. He drew it back, his expression darkening. "That's not snow," he said. "That's ash." Maya's heart lurched as he shoved the truck back into gear and they pitched forward, spinning around the corner of the drive. Up ahead of them, where the Prater Lupus headquarters should have been rising, gold against the gray noon sky, was a gout of black smoke. Jordan swore and slewed the wheel to the left. The truck bumped into a ditch and sputtered out. He kicked his door open and jumped down. Maya followed a second later. The Prater Lupus headquarters had been built on a huge parcel of green land that sloped down to the Sound. The central building was built of golden stone, a Romanesque manor house surrounded by arched porticos. Or it had been. It was a mass of smoking wood and stone now, charred like bones in a crematorium. White powder and ashes blew thickly across the gardens, and Maya choked on the stinging air, bringing a hand up to shield her face. Jordan's brown hair was thickly snowflaked with ash. He stared around them, his expression shocked and uncomprehending. Something caught Maya's eye. A flicker of movement through the smoke. She grabbed Jordan's sleeve. "Look, there's someone there." He took off, skirting the smoking ruin of the Prater building. Maya followed him, though she couldn't help but hang back in horror, staring at the charred remnants of the structure that protruded from the earth. Walls holding up a no longer existing roof, windows that had been blown out or melted, glimpses here and there of white that could have been brick or bones. Jordan stopped ahead of her. Maya moved up to stand beside him. Ash was clinging to her shoes, the grit of it in among the laces. She and Jordan were in the main body of the burned-out buildings. She could see the water in the near distance. The fire hadn't spread, though there were charred dead leaves and blowing ash here, too. And in among the clipped hedgerows, there were bodies. Werewolves of all ages, though mostly young, lay sprawled along the manicured paths, their bodies being slowly covered by ash as if they were being swallowed by a blizzard. Werewolves had an instinct to surround themselves with others of their kind, to live in packs, to draw strength from one another. This many dead lycanthropes felt like a tearing ache, a hole of loss in the world. She remembered the words from Kipling, written on the walls of the Prater. "For the strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack." Jordan was gazing around, his lips moving as he murmured the names of the dead. "Andrea, Teal, Ammon, Grosh, Mara." At the edge of the water, Maya suddenly saw something move, a body, half submerged. She broke into a run, Jordan on her heels. She skidded through the ash to where the grass gave way to sand and dropped down beside the corpse. It was Praetor Scott, corpse bobbing face down, his